with your host, nationally syndicated wine columnist, Robert Whitley.
I'm back, and I'm chatting with Dr. Michael Epstein, a columnist for Wine Review Online, celebrated writer and good friend of mine. And Michael, I know you've always been kind of a Francophile, so you've kind of been on the Chablis train for a long time, but I think a lot of Americans are just now coming around to Chablis. What's going on with that?
I think it's an emergence of the, quote, unoaked Chardonnay trend. I mean, Chablis, in fact, is the quintessential unoaked Chardonnay. It's a special soil of limestone, and the wines have a flinty minerality that makes them quite
great minerality. Yeah,
sometimes a smoky edge to them, and many of the producers years ago did a lot of oak aging. I think there's less oak aging going on in Chablis now, although there's still plenty of it. And that flinty minerality is very appealing and comes out, and I think people are starting to rediscover it as they're rediscovering, you know, you don't have to put Chardonnay in an oak barrel.
Yeah. Well, you know, I do believe that one of the problems with some of the New World Chardonnays that you know, haven't had oak in the past is they've tended to be from lesser vineyards and cheaper, less expensive wines. And so you really weren't seeing the best example. But to find that, if you just turned to Chablis, you would come across some remarkable Chardonnays from great vineyards that had wonderful complexity, the ability to age, and as you have pointed out, this lovely minerality.
And they're not as expensive as wines from the Côte d'Or. I mean, you could still buy Grand Cru Chablis for $50, $60.
Well, see, you took the words right out of my mouth. I was going to say one of the things I really love about it is you can buy Premier Cru and Grand Cru wines from Chablis, and it's not going to cost you what Courton Charlemagne costs.
Right, and the Premier Crus are, you know, $25, $30 a bottle, even in 06, and some of them are stunning.
Spectacular, yeah.
You know, Monday was the first day of the Grand Jour. It was devoted to Chablis. And there were probably 70 producers there, most of whom I had never heard of. It was almost an epiphany to go from producer to producer and taste these wines and realize how many wonderful Chablis are out there, some of which never make it to the United States, some of which do, and I've just not been familiar with the producers. And I quickly, you know, drew up a list of 10 producers, some of whom I've heard and know, and many I had not, from whom I'd happily buy wines.
Now, could you share some of those with us, or do you not have the list with you?
No, I have the list right in front of me. I mean, there are people like Louis Michel. He's a producer brought in by Vineyard Brands, made a stunning array of wines. The Moreau family, Christian Moreau and Louis Moreau,
they've been good producers there for a long time.
Right, when the big Moreau house was purchased by Boisset, Boisset purchased the name but not the vineyards, and the vineyards reverted to the family, and now Christian and Louis Moreau are making wines from those vineyards, and they're both excellent producers. The thing that I had forgotten is that that Joseph Drouin has more land in Chablis than he has in Côte d'Or. And he makes a spectacular array of Chablis.
Yeah, some Grand Cru, some Premier Cru,
exactly.
And even their Village Chablis is very, very good. And it's from their own vineyards.
That's correct, the Vaudon. And it's not expensive.
And it's a terrific wine.
There was a producer who I'd never heard of before, I'm embarrassed to say. His name is Servin, S-E-R-V-I-N.
Yeah, I don't know that one either.
Made luscious wine. I'm less embarrassed now. Made luscious wines. Of course, William Fevre is making great wines. The cooperative there, a cooperative called Les Chablisiennes, it's probably one of the best, along with a cooperative in Barbaresco, it's probably one of the best cooperatives in the wine world.
Is it your sense that the style in Chablis has changed noticeably in, say, over a 20-year period?
I think they've gotten less oaky. I think people have turned back the oak. I know when when Henriot bought, or when Bouchard bought Fèves, they use less oak in aging, and I think it's for the better. I think the wines show their character better, and I think there's just been a higher quality of winemaking in Chablis over the last year.
And probably farming, you know, viticulture too. I think that when I look back and remember some of the early Chablis that I tasted, you really needed to age those for 4 or 5 years before they were approachable and before they really started to show some character. It was almost like drinking water for a while. And nowadays, those wines will continue. I mean, they're very ageable, but they're more complex and they're more voluptuous at a younger age.
And I think the last 5 years, and maybe even longer, that's probably a little bit of global warming at work there, and I think it's certainly better selection. I think that people are realizing that you have to really select if you're going to put out a good wine and have people remember the name of your house.
Well, how much damage do you think was done to the reputation of Chablis by having so much just innocuous white wine produced? You know, I'll be honest, primarily here in California, under the label Chablis, when it wasn't even remotely Chablis. Most of it was Riesling. It was French Colombard and Riesling, and they just called it Chablis because it was white and it sounded cool.
Well, I think a lot of damage was done by that. I think that because people associated Chablis with a 4-gallon jug and a screw cap and didn't really understand what Chablis is. And it also goes back to the difficulty of French marketing by naming wines by where the grapes are grown.
Isn't that an oxymoron?
Chablis is made from Chardonnay.
Isn't that an oxymoron? French marketing? The French just make it, and they just assume that because it's French, you're going to buy it.
Correct. No, that is an oxymoron. You're right.
You know, although they've gotten much better, and you know, to be honest, the guys in the Champagne region are probably the best at it in the business.
There's no question about that. You're absolutely correct.
They've got you convinced that if it's not Champagne, it's not worth your money.
Well, and what they have you more convinced of is that one mark is far superior to another brand, which, you know, there are certainly different styles, but I'm not sure I would say that one is far superior to another.
Yeah.
But the prices would let you know that they are, and the sales would let you know that they are.
You know, I had a little a blog item on Champagne just a few days ago. And I seem to I have the sense that Champagne prices, even though the dollar continues to slide against the euro, have come back a little bit. And I'm thinking it's because these guys are pretty sharp and they don't want to lose their market share here in the U.S.
Could be.
Have you noticed that on the East Coast?
Yeah, the prices, they're still much higher than they were 3 years ago. But they seem to have abated a little bit. And it may be the growers, you know, they've just expanded the AOC. They've just included another half dozen or dozen communes and villages that are allowed to carry, they're allowed to grow Champagne grapes now.
And that was very controversial.
The prospect of expanding the supply over the next decade.
One thing, though, that I will say about that, the expanded appellation for Champagne really doesn't even take it back to the size that it was 100 years ago.
Right. And they're not that, those wines aren't going to be online for 20 years. But I'm thinking that maybe it's the prospect of that is lowering. I don't know. I mean, I can never understand why these prices go up and down.
Well, if we could figure that out,
we'd be very rich.
Yeah. Yeah. So in your travels on this Jour de Bourgogne, what were the – I'll just throw this out there. What were the three or four producers who impressed you most, and with which wines?
Well, I was impressed, again, in Chablis with some of the people I named. Cervin, because I hadn't known them before. Vaucouray, because I've tasted only a few of his wines in Boston and had the opportunity to taste a large array of them, and they were delicious. In
Did you
in
make it
Rhone
to
Romane? I had an opportunity to visit and taste La Marche's wines, and they're the sole owner of one of the less well-known Grand Crus that's right across the road from Romani Conti. They own La Grand Rue.
Now, did you make it to any of the red areas in the Côte de Beaune, like Volnay?
Did not make it to Volnay. Made it to Corton.
Yeah, because one of my favorite producers is down there, Lafarge, Michel Lafarge. I don't know if you're familiar with his wines.
No, I was particularly taken with a producer in Chambon by the name of Barthod, Barthod. Ghislain Barthod made wonderful wines in 06, along with Rumier.
Don't know that one. You know, we need to spend a couple of nights dining at Ma Cuisine in Beaune and bone up on our producers that we're not familiar with, because they have
night.
A great wine list there. Anyway, Michael Epstein, I want to thank you for sharing some of your experiences from Burgundy with us, and we're going to take a break now, and when we come back, we're going to visit with the kitchen diva, Maria Montana. Whitley on Wine will continue following these messages.
And now, back to Whitley on Wine.
Slowly.
With your host, nationally syndicated wine columnist, Robert Whitley.
I'm back, and I trust you enjoyed our visit with Michael Epstein of Wine Review Online. Originally, Michael was just going to be with me for one 15-minute segment, but he did an admirable job pinch-hitting for Tom Gamble of Source Napa, who's out with a cold, couldn't do the show today, so we'll have Tom on at a future date. We'll reschedule him. And I'm joined now here in the studio by Maria Montana. She's the food editor of Ranch and Coast magazine, and we're going to talk a little bit about wine and food. Now, we're kind of changing the subject a little bit. Maria, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Robert.
Okay.
Nice to be here.
What is on your mind today?
Avocados are on my mind today.
Why are avocados on your mind?
Because I have a tree in my backyard.
And so you're selling them.
That does not produce. It's been like 4 years and hasn't produced. I'm always like yelling at my husband about it. So we might have to chop it.
Oh.
But love avocados.
That's
love
a sad story.
I know.
Yeah,
because it's beautiful. It's
can't you give it another year or two?
Well, apparently you're supposed to get another tree to help it. You know, they pollinate each other.
Yeah.
So we bought like a little miniature one. It's sitting next to this big one, and
I wouldn't chop the tree. Then I'd get another tree.
Well, we planted it, but it's still. We're going to give it one more year.
Okay,
one more year.
That sounds good. I mean, you know, you got to make guacamole, right?
Love guacamole.
So obviously, you know, when we discussed what you were going to talk about and you mentioned avocados, they're in season now.
Right. Yeah. Well, actually, in California, they're, you know, in season throughout the year. But, you know, you go to Henry's or Whole Foods and you'll see them more lying around. And I think people don't really know what to do with them.
Certain times of the year, though, I find that they're like little hockey pucks.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes they're better than others.
Right. Exactly. This is the time to get them right now. Mm-hmm. And throughout, you know, the summer, throughout spring and then summer.
So what should people look for when they're buying an avocado?
Well, it should be like kind of, it depends on the avocado. Usually it's the brand that you get is the Haas brand. I mm-hmm. like the Haas brand because it has a thicker skin. It's kind of shaped like a pear.
And is this a green one or one of the ones that's kind of started to turn brown?
Well, actually, that's the myth about avocados is that they never ripen on the tree. Mm-hmm. So if you left your avocado on a tree, it would never ripen. So when you get them in the store, they're always going to be hard, unless you go to a special section where they're
right.
ripe. I advise you to get one that's hard and ripen that at home.
Yeah, I mean, I was just kidding about that. When I buy avocados, I'll get one that's ready to go, so you can do some guacamole.
But it's hard to find it ready to go.
Or put it in a salad. You can get close sometimes. Especially if you go to Whole Foods, you know. And then you get some that are a little harder. You know, it's going to take those 2 or 3 or 4 days to kind of ripen up and be ready. But is there anything in the physical appearance on the outside that's noticeable? I'm not going to buy it, or you wouldn't buy it because of blah, blah, blah?
Well, usually if the skin looks like really dark and it's really like mushy, I wouldn't buy it. I like to buy it firm and like ripen it at home.
And ripen it at home.
And you can ripen it in a paper bag in a cool place. Mm-hmm. Or I like to lay mine flat in a box and put it in my pantry and just close the door. Then they're all ripe kind of at the same time, and then you can refrigerate them for up to 2 days.
Okay, now we've got our avocado ripe. What are we going to do with it?
Well, I love, I'm Italian, so I grew up with the Mediterranean diet, basically. And I'm a big believer in the Mediterranean diet and everything in moderation. Of course, the avocado.
Yeah, I always have guacamole when I go to Florence. I'm kidding. You. I'm kidding.
I was going to say. Why is that?
But I... I'm just teasing.
Okay. What was I saying?
I do spend a lot of time in Italy.
Yeah, it's a great place.
So avocados are good for you.
Well, they're good for you. And they have the good monosaturated fats, like that's what's in olive oil or what's in nuts. But you don't want to, like, everything in moderation. I wouldn't eat, guacamole every single day. But it's good. It's good for you when you do eat it.
Yeah.
I like to take, like, maybe three or four and stick them when they're ripe, of course, put them in a bowl, use some crushed garlic. And I like to use, a lot of people do the Cuisinart where they blend it all and like the dips you'd get in the store.
And almost puree it.
Yeah, I don't really like that. I kind of like the chunky.
I like to guacamole. I do it with a fork.
Right,
And there are a couple of restaurants in town that will make guacamole tableside. That's how they do it.
It's the best way to have it.
They put it in a bowl
They
salt and pepper it. And
that's
maybe throw a little jalapeno in there and then they...
Or whatever you like, little salt and pepper, a little lemon juice. And lemon juice will keep it from,
turning brown.
Right, exactly. Yeah. I think everybody kind of knows that. Yeah. But
so do you have a special recipe for your guacamole?
The only way... I just make it very simply. I just throw ingredients in. Like, the Italian way to do it is not to measure. We just throw it in. So I do salt and pepper, maybe a clove of crushed garlic.
So a pinch of this and a pinch of that.
Right. We don't measure. So it's like...
Okay, so
the
then,
neighbors will ask
and then
me
you mix
for
it up, and then you taste it a little bit, and you say, okay, it needs a little more salt.
Right, exactly.
And what about the spiciness? Do you put a little jalapeno in?
I like a little jalapeno in mine.
Yeah.
And maybe a little cilantro.
But, I like cilantro in it, but...
Not too much.
I made some guacamole a couple of weeks ago, and I had this jalapeno, and cut up the whole jalapeno, put it in there, and it wasn't hot at all. Every once in a while, you get a jalapeno
that's not hot. But it still had some flavor.
Yeah, it had flavor. It did. And it had some crunch, too.
You could use a habanero. But you'd want to use very little.
Yeah. Well, that would... The habanero, I think, would be... make it very difficult for matching wine with your guacamole.
Right, exactly.
And we were talking about that leading up to the show. What wines would you have with avocado? And we were thinking Chardonnay because it's creamy.
And buttery.
And
the avocado's buttery.
So is avocado. So that's a really good match. But it also depends on what you're doing with it. If the dominant theme is avocado, that's one thing, but if the avocado is just an accent, then that's something else. You're gonna choose your wine to, like you mentioned, a steak.
Like if you make a steak and you want to slice some avocado and blue cheese on top, then I think the dominant factor would be the steak.
Now, wouldn't blue cheese kind of kill the avocado flavor?
No, I think it adds to the flavor.
Salts it up a little bit.
Yeah, I think it adds it and adds a little bit of texture and a little bit of salt, so you don't need to salt the avocado.
Yeah.
And I think it's very, very delicious with steak.
Yeah, and you could easily have a red wine with that.
What would you suggest?
Oh, a Cabernet or, I like big red wines when I have a steak. Cabernet or Syrah, something along those lines.
Yeah, that would be nice.
But
I'm a big Pinot fan, by the way. Pinot Noir.
That could work. Depending on the weight of the Pinot. Some Pinots are lighter and don't have as much color as others. So what are some of the other preparations? I mean, we talked about guacamole, and that's sort of, in San Diego anyway, that would be traditional. But what are some of the other uses that you find for avocados?
Well, it's funny that you mentioned that. I was just talking to a neighbor friend of mine yesterday, and she was discussing what she likes to do with halibut, or if she likes to grill, a piece of fish on the grill. It's nice to mix the avocado. You could do it with pineapple. You can do it with mangoes, which are in season right now.
Mm-hmm.
And just add a little, just a touch of salt and pepper and toss it with a little bit of red onion, and it makes a nice...
So this would be chunky. It wouldn't be like sliced avocado.
No, it would be more like chop it finely, mm-hmm. more like a chutney for the fish, something like that would right. be really nice on top.
And that's good with fish. You like that?
Yeah, I do like that.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever put like a you're talking kind of an avocado mango salsa to go on
right,
top
which is
of
really
a piece of
which
fish.
Is really in now because it's like you know kind of the latest thing. To
do you have a recipe?
Yes, I do.
Oh, well, let's have it. Don't hold back.
Okay, I won't hold back. I have the it's like a pineapple avocado salsa, mm-hmm. but I like to use the mangoes instead of the pineapple. But you could do either, you know, whichever you like.
Well, that's going to affect my wine choice. With the pineapple, I'm going to have a Riesling.
Sounds delicious.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
perfect.
With the mango, you know, probably something more along the lines of a Gewürztraminer.
Oh, that would be nice.
Mm-hmm.
Love
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
yeah.
So anyway, let's have the recipe here.
Okay.
Before we run out of time.
Okay, let's not run out of time. I would do about a half a cup of diced fresh mango and two plum tomatoes seeded and cut. I would do two firm ripe avocados diced finely, half a cup of a chopped sweet onion. And you can do about...
Now, you say a sweet onion. Is that a yellow onion, a white onion?
Or I would do a red onion.
A red onion?
Yeah.
You consider that sweet? Okay.
I kind of like the red onion.
Okay, great.
And I would do about maybe just like a quarter cup of the cilantro leaves. And then I would do some minced jalapenos. I would make... Depending on how spicy you want it. You know, if you're going to take a whole jalapeno, it's going to be pretty hot.
Okay.
So I would do maybe a half.
But you're going to balance that with the sweetness of the fruit.
Right. But it's still going to give that bite, you know, and you don't want to be able to taste the taste it without having to burn your mouth, you know, and not enjoy the rest of your meal.
Sure. Okay.
And then about a third of a cup of fresh lime juice and 2 tablespoons of extra virgin olive oil and salt and pepper to taste. And so, you could leave out the pepper if you're going to do the jalapeno.
Now, what kind of fish? You mentioned halibut. What other kind of fish? Is maybe grilled swordfish, grilled mahi-mahi? This would work with all of
them. Or even like a nice grilled tuna or like a tilapia or any kind of like white fish that you really like.
Mm-hmm. That sounds
delicious. I love halibut.
Yeah. Now,
Or even just a cod. You could do a cod, too.
Now, would you use this salsa with anything other than, say, grilled fish? Does it work with other things?
Well, you could use it. Well, it's really good with fish, but like I like fish tacos, so I'm like big fish taco fan. I don't know. I'm from Washington State, and when I moved to California, it was like fish tacos were everywhere. So I would like that in a fish taco.
That sounds good.
With a little bit of shredded cabbage.
You know, on the Gourmet Club before the Whitley Online Show, we had Maureen Clancy, and I asked her what was her favorite fish taco in town.
And, what did she say?
Well, she mentioned a place that I don't know, and I'm having trouble remembering the name. But I like a place on India Street close to where I live called Blue Water. They make a very, very good fish taco.
I'll have to check that out.
Very fresh fish, and they load it up with stuff. And I also think, you know, even though it's a chain, it's a small chain, I think the Brigantine fish taco is pretty good.
Wow, I'll have to check that one out, too.
But anyway, with my fish tacos, with that salsa, I'm going to go with a Riesling or Gewürztraminer. What we call the aromatic white wines.
Sounds delicious.
Now, see how time flies when you're having fun?
I know. We just had fun. We need some wine here in the studio.
Anyway, that's all we have time for this week.
Thank
this
you,
is
Robert.
Robert Whitley for Whitley on Wine saying until next week. Ciao. Talk to me nice. You've got to wine.